found themselves faced with a terrible scandal, they acted. The same may be true in many other places. That may be what you have to do. That's up to you to decide. What I do want to say here is it can only be a step along the way. Confrontation, however necessary it may be, must lead to conversation if it is really to bring about powerful change. I ask you to consider this. The major changes that we seek cannot at present come from any source other than the Pope. And we must be aware of the relative powerlessness of the bishops before the power of the papacy and the Vatican systems that support it. Now, in dealing with bishops here, you'll be dealing with some who will defend the colour of the shoes the Pope wears. Oh, I've heard them do it. But you'll find others who may have thought many of the things I've talked about today, many of the things I have in the book. But they're not going to tell that to you. They're afraid it'll appear in the newspaper the next day. They're afraid it'll be back in Rome the day after that. And they're afraid they'll be sacked the day after that. Remember what I said, which is very true. I've given an example in my book of the short leash that the bishop is on, where I said to a group of 40 victims, I was asked a direct question, are you happy with the level of support you're getting from Rome? And I thought for a second, I said, no. In the paper the next day, bang, came the letters from Rome, even at the end saying the matter has been deferred to the congregation for the doctrine of the faith. In other words, that I was suspected of heresy for saying I was not happy with the level of support I was getting from Rome on this issue of sexual abuse. So, you know, this is what you're dealing with. And I'm trying to say to you, confrontation where it's essential, yes, but it must somehow lead on to conversation somewhere if we are ever to really change. You need the support of the bishops. Anyway, the third part of my answer is that we need to have this conversation, not just with leaders, but as widely as possible among all members of the church. The greater the number of people involved, the more they understand the issues, the more chance we have of change. Mahatma Gandhi once said, beautiful phrase, we must be the change we wish to see in the world. We must be the change we wish to see in the world. And the church I wish to see is a church of conversation. So that is what we must be in the world, in the church today. The final part of my answer is that I believe that the best way to engage reluctant leaders in conversation is precisely through the issue of sexual abuse. For the scandal of abuse has been so great that it is arguably the one issue that has the energy to produce change. All church leaders, without exception, have at the very least been through a profound humiliation and embarrassment, that's the least that can be said, over this issue. Deep within them, they know that the Pope did not give them leadership. And they also know that there's much to be done before they can face the future with a clear conscience. Many, sadly, are sort of hoping, well, we can put this behind us now and get on with other things. And they're slow to accept the idea that until they face this, it's really impossible for them to talk about anything else because nobody's believing them. People are saying, well, get your own house in order, then we might listen to you, but not until then. So they're very slow, and yet they know in their hearts that we haven't done what we had to do. So provided it's done in a spirit of conversation rather than confrontation, may I suggest some of the issues that can be raised? Here I'll be trying to put words in your mouth. You'll have to decide whether they belong there. We have been so profoundly shocked by the revelations of sexual abuse that our faith in the church itself has been severely damaged. In addition, as parents and grandparents, We are deeply concerned for the protection of our children, and we feel that as yet not nearly enough has been done to ensure their safety into the future. We believe that Pope John Paul II should have handled the two cases of Cardinal Gröhr and Father Degollado promptly and openly. Indeed, we expected a far stronger lead from that Pope in the very beginning, and we're left confused by a person who gave such strong leadership in other fields and then gave no leadership in the field that concerned us most. Despite the welcome statements made recently in the United States by Pope Benedict, we believe there is still a need for a public apology by the Pope directly to victims, made in St. Peter's Basilica surrounded by the cardinals, assuring victims, first of all, that they were not guilty of any fault because they were victims of someone more powerful than they were, because that person was abusing a power the church had given him. Apologizing for all the ways in which teaching structures or attitudes within the church may have contributed, and assuring the victims that the church will investigate all aspects of the matter in order to eradicate abuse in the future. We are by no means satisfied, however, that the church is in fact doing everything possible to uncover the causes of abuse and to eradicate them. We believe that as a first step, there is a need to study all the ways in which church teachings, attitudes, laws, and practices contribute to unhealthy psychology, unhealthy ideas, and unhealthy living conditions. We know that celibacy is not the sole cause of abuse, but we also know that it's impossible to say that it has made no contribution. So we wish to see a particular study of this matter, especially of the ways in which an unwanted, unaccepted, and unassimilated celibacy can contribute to unhealthy psychology, for example, severe depression, unhealthy ideas, for example, misogyny, and unhealthy living conditions, for example, lack of support and loneliness in the life of the priest or religious. Looking beyond these immediate issues, we believe that no study will be adequate unless it looks at all matters relating to power and sex within the church. The ones I've spoken about, the idea of priests and religious being taken up, the need to protect the good name of the church at all costs, the inability to look at issues surrounding abuse in a fresh light because of the fear that any questions might harm papal authority, the idea that abuse was primarily a direct offence against God rather than offensive to God because of the harm caused to children, and the need to distinguish between forgiveness of past wrong and prevention of future wrong. We have been most unhappy with the overall response to abuse by church authorities at every level, and we ask for an investigation of why this was so. In particular, we ask for a study of any and all institutional factors that may have contributed to the inadequacy of the response and to such practices as the moving of offending priests from one parish to another. We believe that part of the problem was that each diocese and each religious order responded separately, so that the overall response was most uneven, and the whole country inevitably ended up being judged by its worst cases. And that's what exactly what happened in this country. We believe that the means must exist whereby the whole country can respond as one in times of crisis. And that means, quite simply, where the majority of bishops can coerce the others to act with them as one. At the moment, they can't do that. One single good and holy man, Pope John Paul II, was unable, for whatever reasons, to respond adequately to this crisis, and the whole church suffered as a result of that inadequacy of one person. We believe that the ideas of collegiality and the sensus fide of the whole church, both proclaimed by the Second Vatican Council, must, as a matter of urgency, be given concrete expression in specific structures that, had they existed, would have enabled a coordinated and far better response to abuse by the whole church. They didn't exist, and so we did depend on one single person. Finally, we know that there are very large numbers of sincere and devout Catholics who have serious problems with many church teachings concerning power and sex. We feel that these Catholics are so many and so serious and so sincere that they deserve honest conversation on these topics rather than the imposition of authority or condemnation. An early title that I thought of giving to the book was Nothing So Ugly, Nothing So Beautiful. This is based on a letter that John Henry Newman wrote to a friend a year or two before he took the step of joining the church. In that letter he wrote, "There is nothing on this earth so ugly as the Catholic Church, and nothing so beautiful." Wonderful phrase, isn't it? In the midst of the revelations of sexual abuse and of many of the grubbier details of the response, the church was so ugly that outsiders turned away in disgust, while insiders felt a deep shame and confusion. Now, I know that I'm speaking largely to people who have not left the church, and you've not left because you have seen and experienced the beauty. If you cannot see the ugliness, you're closing your eyes. But if you cannot see the beauty, you do not know the church. If I have personally encountered some of the ugliest things in the church in the story of abuse, I have also been in a privileged position to see some of the most beautiful, not least in all those people who were willing to get down into the mud and the filth in order to respond. Despite some of the reactions there have been to my book, it is emphatically not an attack on the church or a desire to cause it harm. On the contrary, it comes out of an intense desire to see a better church, a church in which everything that is humanly possible has been done to eradicate abuse, a church that encourages growth through freedom, a church in which there is conversation rather than confrontation, a church in which all, women as much as men, laity as much as clergy, share equally in the full life of the church and can grow to become all they're capable of being. By reclaiming the spirit of Jesus, I want to see a new church for a new millennium. Thank you.
Your enthusiastic response really says that we really see you, Jeffrey, as a beautiful man, truly beautiful man. Wow. And I don't see any evidence of a leash. The title of Bishop Robinson's first chapter in his book is Healthy People in a Healthy Relationship with a Healthy God. It really puts it in great perspective throughout the whole study. Conversation rather than confrontation. We have some microphones back there and over here, and is there another standing mic? Just one? Okay, just two mics. Let's start the conversation with Bishop Robinson.
If you are able to stand, we prefer that you go to the microphone in the back. But if you prefer to ask your question by staying seated, flag me down and I will come to you.
The question that I had was, or I guess the statement I have is that I feel that besides the victims receiving as a member of the Catholic Church who supports the church should also receive an apology. And I haven't really heard that. I haven't heard the bishop say, we were wrong, and we really... I'm sure part of it maybe is because of the legalities, because maybe they're admitting stuff, although certainly they've already admitted it with diocese going bankrupt. And I just feel like there is a treating of the laity as not important, that they go up rather than to go down, and that as long as that it doesn't really matter what the laity think or the fact that the laity also have suffered. I just want to make that comment.
Thank you. Yeah, I totally agree. Yes, I spoke of the apology to victims because I think that's got to be at the center of it. But there are other people. I mean, you know, the parents of victims are desperately in need of that kind of apology too, because they are blaming themselves. You know, I was the one who trusted the priest, etc. And many, many other people. And yet the whole church has got to be directed to.
Okay, go ahead. Bishop, I think I've been totally naive for 70 years to be a Catholic and honestly not realize that this sort of thing was going on. Mm-hmm. My brother was a server. I knew all of his buddies, and you know, I never knew such a thing happened. And my question is, do you think there were people who were using the church to hide this thing about themselves, that did it with malice aforethought, or maybe not with malice aforethought, but kind of hid in the church so that they could perpetuate this kind of behavior?
Yeah, okay. Thank you for the question. We were all naive. I knew nothing about, didn't know such things could exist until, you know, really the revelation started coming. Do I think that any people entered the church with the idea of then abusing? Actually, no. I'll tell you why. Firstly, there are two types of pedophile: the fixated pedophile and the aggressive pedophile. And the fixated pedophile would never have the self-control to wait the 7 years of preparation before getting ordained. It just wouldn't happen. The regressive pedophiles, sadly, it's far more likely that happened during during seminary, during priesthood. There's no one profile of pedophiles, no psychological profile, that is, and there's no real means by which you can tell in advance who's going to offend and who isn't. As I've suggested, but you know, please, psychologists will tell you there's much they do not understand in this field. I have suggested that we need to look at three fields: unhealthy psychology, unhealthy ideas, unhealthy living conditions. I suggest it's when those three come together that it's most likely that you get this kind of regression. Or cases where, you know, you're dealing with, say, a heterosexual person, but for various reasons they do offend with minors. You know, you'd know this, that when you take, say, a great number of one sex and put them in a particular environment, like a prison, then homosexual sex can take place, not because that's what's preferred, because that alone is what's available. It would seem that something of that did happen here. There are other cases I know where a person was taken into the seminary at a very early age, and because of the environment, their psychosexual development was stunted, and they remained psychosexually at the age of about 15. And so other 15-year-olds were attractive to them. You know, this is where I'm saying, when the three elements come together, you're more likely to have this sort of stuff arising. But in brief answer to your overall question, I'd need convincing that anyone actually entered the seminary saying, "And this is so that I can offend." in 7 years' time?
Hello, Bishop Robinson. Hello. I'm a mother of a son who was abused in the Cincinnati Archdiocese. You may have received our testimony this week. We spoke to Bishop Gumbleton, and I believe he sent it
on to me. Thank you.
And so you are aware, and I will just very quickly make the folks here aware of what happened in 2002. Our son was able to finally come forward to the bishop and the district attorney. We went to visit Archbishop Daniel Pelagic, hoping for consolation. And this is what I'm hoping somehow that you, as a fellow bishop and friend to many of these other men, can speak to them about conversation. When we went to meet Archbishop Pelagic, there was a very terse, "I'm sorry for what happened to you." We then began to talk to him, just wanting to him to understand, to say, "What can I do for you?" His first several words were, "I don't know if we," when we ask him questions, "I don't know about that. I'll have to ask my lawyer. I'm not sure about that question. Father Armstrong is our canon lawyer. Father Armstrong, what does canon law have to say about that question?" The other thing that happened was that at least three times he looked at his watch and he said, "Is there anything else?" When our son asked, he said, "Well, he didn't know." And our son asked if could there possibly be any legal resolution to this. He says, "Oh, no, you know, that couldn't be." And our son said, "Well, he could at least go to jail." And he says, "Oh, no." He says, "He has to eat. David's abuser must eat, must be taken care of." And so I'm hoping that somehow, and I just sent another letter to Archbishop Pelagic this week, but somehow you can convince your fellow bishops to please have conversation with us as well as us with them, because it was not us who started this confrontation.
I know it was not you who started the confrontation. Let me confess my embarrassment. He's the one bishop in this country I actually know. He was 1 year ahead of me in the seminary in Rome. And all I can tell you is he wasn't like that then. He wasn't. He was a very, very good, he was a good friend. And you know, this is a long, long, I'm talking 50 years ago now, when I knew him. Someone else was going to give him a copy of the book too, by the way, so he might end up with... He might end up with two, yeah. You know, the very least that a bishop owes to a victim and to parents of a victim is to sit and listen to them, to listen to their story. I mean, when you meet anyone, if you're going, the relationship's going to go anywhere, you must hear their story. I don't mean the externals, I went to school here, I mean the story in here. That's how any marriage grows, it's how any friendship grows. We listen to one another's story. There's no other way to become friends with someone. You know, normally when you meet someone, you don't get the whole story at the very first meeting, you get it more gradually, but you get it. And when you're a bishop and your parents of a victim come to see you, you listen to that story. There's no other way. I can't give you an explanation. It's not the man I knew, not even remotely. What's happened, I can't tell you. But thank you very much for sharing. As I say, Bishop Gumbleton did hand it on to me, so I had read all of this before you came. I'm glad you identify yourself. Thank you for doing that. I think everybody here feels with you in your story. Well, you know, feels with you. I'm not pretending that they can. You know, everyone here can understand. Yeah, it's terrible for a victim, but it's equally terrible for parents, isn't it? The blaming of self, the all of that. Well, you were not to blame. You were not at fault. Someone who had far more power abused, and in doing so abused the power the church had given. And for that, insofar as anything from myself matters, I apologize. Thank you.